Our reporters have been on the road this month, a year before the next presidential election, to report on the hard times many Americans are facing. As part of our series, NPR's David Shaper visits the suburb of Chicago, a suburb, and a single mother who lost her well-paying job. She's among those faced with starting over after spending a long time out of work.
Walk in the door of Alice Eastman's house in suburban Wheaton, Illinois, and you're greeted right away by two rambunctious young Labradors.
Zeus is the black lab and Crash is the yellow lab.
Eastman says she's had the older one, Zeus, for about 2 years.
He kept the sanity because I was sending a son to college. Another one was going to be playing volleyball and varsity sports, so he was out of the house all the time. So I had this house to myself, no job.
Well, Eastman had a job, a pretty good one, making $75,000 a year at the Park District in the nearby Chicago suburb of Bolingbrook, heading up its Department of Natural Resources.
I was hired as the first superintendent of that department. My first day on the job was interviewing architects to build a nature center, which was pretty awesome.
In almost 5 years at the Park District, Eastman oversaw construction of the LEED Platinum Certified Nature Center, hired its staff, and ran its educational and conservation programs. But in August of 2010, she was let go as new Park District leadership started cutting costs and eliminating some of the higher salaries.
I'm not even sure what the right term is. I was angry and demoralized.
So with a degree in botany and 20-plus years of experience in natural resources, Alice Eastman joined the growing ranks of the unemployed.
I was let go on a Friday, and I was on the phone and online on Monday registering for unemployment.
Though it's about a third of what she was making, Eastman says the $531 a week in unemployment benefits she gets for her and her 17-year-old son kept the lights on, put food on the table, and helped pay the mortgage, while she looked and looked and looked for new jobs in her field and found nothing.
Not that many municipalities and park districts are spending money on natural resource management right now.
So Eastman started casting a wider net, applying for just about anything.
I think I applied for almost 50 different positions between August and March. I got one phone call, one reply saying, yeah, come interview. And that was at Target. One.
So when Target offered her part-time work last March at $8.25 an hour, Alice Eastman took it.
Minimum wage. I haven't worked minimum wage for 22 years, but there you go. I'm working with an architect. I'm working with a couple engineers.
That she's not alone as a once highly paid professional in a part-time job paying Illinois' minimum wage makes it a bit easier to swallow. And Eastman just recently got promoted to a full-time team lead position at her Target store. So she now makes $12 an hour with benefits. Alice Eastman is grateful for what she has. And as she turned 45 this week, she acknowledges she's entering a new, uncertain phase of her life.
I kind of look at it as I've climbed to pretty much the top of the one ladder, and now I'm starting at the bottom rung of a different ladder. It's a job. It's not a career. I had the career. I would love to be able to go back to a career. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to in what I was doing. Not here. I know I can't here.
So Alice Eastman has just put her modest home in suburban Wheaton up for sale. And after her youngest son heads off to college next year, she's looking to maybe move south in hopes of finding a new life's work. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
College graduates face one of the bleakest job markets on record. Reporter Sarah Covedo of TurnstileNews.com met an aspiring accountant who emailed resumes for 6 months. And then tried on something more daring.
Alexander Monsanto has achieved a lot of firsts. He's a first-generation American, the first in his family to graduate high school, and the first to get a college degree. All eyes are on him to succeed, but it's been 10 months since he got his accounting degree from Florida Atlantic University, and still no job.
There are times where I would question what I was doing. I studied accounting for 4 years. If it's going to be this difficult to get a job, is this a field that I want to be in?
One morning, he says, he responded to every Craigslist ad in the San Francisco Bay Area that mentioned accounting and didn't receive a single response.
It turns into like this vicious cycle where it's not helping to stay home to look for a job. You kind of have to just get out of the house and go and network, put yourself out there. I needed to find something different.
It's 7:45 in the morning, and the lanky 25-year-old boards a commuter bus to San Francisco, holding a sandwich board with the words "Hire Me" spelled out on the front with big black sticky letters. Monsanto steps off the bus, pulls the straps over his shoulders, and begins walking the streets of the financial district. His "Hire Me" sign beats against his chest with every step. It's a moment that he says fills him with embarrassment every time.
Whatever it takes, that's what I keep telling myself. I mean, a lot of people probably think I'm crazy, but I'm not.
Not crazy at all, because it actually works. Monsanto says he gets twice as many interviews with his sandwich board, 3 to 4 per week. At one point, Kim Tobias passes by. It turns out she's a corporate recruiter who wants a resume.
I think it's, you know, a little wacky, but I think that it would work. Shows me that he's really interested in finding a job. He's got initiative. That's even better than LinkedIn.
A few blocks later, a woman calls out to him, "Hey, you in the sandwich board?" Janet Myers works at the University of California, and she has a tip for him.
Check out the UC website. They're looking for, like, a bunch of accounting clerks to do part
really?
Of the grant process. Yeah.
The University of California?
Yes.
Can I use you as a referral?
Sure.
All right. UC.
While he scribbles down the job details, Eric Schroeder, a senior VP at the insurance giant Aon, pulls out his phone and snaps a picture, promising to post it on his LinkedIn profile.
Here's my card.
Do you want a copy of my resume?
Please.
Yeah, all right. Here you go.
I'm going to post it on LinkedIn and just say, here's an enterprising young man.
One of Monsanto's favorite stories is about the day he met his potentially perfect match. Representatives from the solar company Sunrun were on the same street corner in downtown San Francisco, wearing T-shirts with the advertisement, "We're hiring." Susan Wise, a PR manager at Sunrun, was stoked about the chance encounter.
Here they were proactively seeking job seekers, and they bumped into this guy who was doing his own little guerrilla marketing thing for seeking a job.
Monsanto followed up with a resume and even landed an interview, but no job.
I think what happened was just the opportunities we had listed weren't really a fit for his background. But I think it's a good example of how the concept of a mutual fit is tremendously important.
With so many mid-career job seekers competing for the same positions, it's hard for newcomers like Monsanto to be that perfect fit employers are looking for. So forced to face the reality of paying bills, Alexander Monsanto has put his dreams of a full-time accounting job on hold. Instead, he's willing to accept a part-time or even temporary job as an accountant. And in the meantime, he keeps beating the streets in his sandwich board.
You know anyone who needs an accountant?
No.
Yeah.
Creative idea, though.
Yeah.
For NPR News, I'm Sarah Quevedo.
Sarah Quevedo is a reporter for TurnstileNews.com. That's a project of Youth Radio.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block. A 12th century epic poem from Persia, The Conference of the Birds, is now adapted in a gorgeously illustrated book by Peter Cease. Cease is known for his many children's books, where a boy might be transformed into a fire truck, or a New York City neighborhood becomes a fantastical playground. Cease grew up behind the Iron Curtain in then-communist Czechoslovakia.
I think the really connecting thing in all my books, it's the fact that somebody's dreaming about places or searching for some place, going places. I think if I wouldn't have left Prague, my books would be different. And I think everything I did in my books in this country comes from that sentiment of leaving another place and coming to the new place.
The Conference of the Birds is the first book for adults from Peter Cease. It's the story of thousands of birds who fly off on a perilous journey over mountains and oceans and deserts in search of their king, only to find in the end that the king is them.
I think it's like everybody's trying to find like a solution. Everybody hears about some person who will solve all the problems. And then in the end, you find out that you have to sort of resolve it for yourself, that it's a reflection of what's inside of you.
Peter Cease, I wonder if you would read the page where the hoopoe, the leader bird, is telling the conference of birds, all the birds from all over the world, what they must do and why they have to do it.
I try my best. The hoopoe says, "Birds, look at the troubles happening in our world. Anarchy, discontent, upheaval. desperate fights over territory, water, and food. Poisoned air, unhappiness. I fear we are lost. We must do something. I've seen the world. I know many secrets. Listen to me. I know of a king who has all the answers. We must go and find him.
I want to ask you about this incredible image. This is Hupo, before the birds start out, addressing all of the birds in the world. And you see him in the middle of this throng of these incredible birds, some of which are magical and some of which look quite realistic, flamingos and owls and ducks and eagles. And tell me a bit about the technique here, because people who know your work will recognize it right away with this tiny, tiny, incredibly detailed dots and filled in with this incredible wash of color.
Well, thank you. This was taking forever, of course. And with these pictures, which take forever, it's like, is this really necessary? Especially now, because people say, oh, wow, you could do it on some computer machine like so much faster, especially like little kids. Coincidentally, the new wing of Metropolitan Museum in New York, the Islamic wing, just opened. And they have an illustration from the 13th century for the Conference of the Birds.
The original.
And they have the beautiful painting where the artist put in just like, I think, 10 birds. And the text says all the birds of the world got together. So either they didn't have that many birds in Persia, or it's that wonderful poetic license that he just used few of them. So I'm so glad that you noticed that it's so many birds, but maybe I should have been smarter about it.
Was that one of those sort of smack your head moments, thinking, why didn't I think of that? Peter Cease, tell me, how did you do this work? What's the technique you're using here?
The technique here is pen and ink and watercolor. And for me, it was like going back to my history in animation, because I had all this space to play with, because this book wasn't ever limited in number of pages. Here I was allowed to go whatever. I was going so long at this book that my wife at one point said, like, we better get it out of the house.
She got really,
well, she's realistic.
She got a little tired of it.
Birds everywhere. I was talking to young people, if there are any programs on computer, how to make thousands of birds sort of multiply them. But I didn't find anybody who would be able to help me. So I still had to do it with a little brush.
So if I need to draw 5,000 tiny little birds.
Yeah, it's getting more and more tedious, because now it involves like physical therapy and stuff like that.
Physical therapy? You're saying it's physically painful. These are such minute, careful work.
I just want you to feel sorry for me.
Well, no. I do.
It is also revolt. No, it can be physically painful, but then when you see the beautiful picture in the end, you think, oh, this is a beautiful picture. You still have that satisfaction that you know it's special what you have done.
What is it with you and birds? Are you fascinated by them apart from this story?
I think, you know, I was like thinking about it because I didn't realize I'm fascinated by birds. But I think growing up in the communist country behind the Iron Curtain, the birds never needed passports. The birds would always like fly over the head. And I remember that like we always thought like the birds can go wherever they want. We couldn't really. So the birds were very much the symbol of something which doesn't have to follow the rules of whatever country. So I think the birds were a symbol of the free movement for me.
Well, Peter Cease, thanks so much for coming in.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
That's author and illustrator Peter Cease. You can see a series of images from his book, The Conference of the Birds, at npr.org.
The Thanksgiving holiday is next week, and while many hosts are still refining their menus or planning their travel, many school children are probably learning the legend of the first Thanksgiving, a feast of thanks held after the native people of the area taught the English pilgrims to survive in a world that was new to them. The irony, of course, is that the holiday survived, while the language and the culture of the people who made it all possible seemed to be on the verge of extinction. But the language and the people did not die. A new film produced and directed by Anne Makepeace tells the story of how the Wampanoag people recovered their language, a language that had not been spoken for more than a century. And with that language, they also recovered a vital piece of culture and American history. In English, the film is called We Still Live Here. It will air nationally on PBS tomorrow night. And Anne Makepeace is with us now, along with Troy Currents, who is vice president of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And this film tells a fascinating story. In 1993, Jesse Little Doe Baird, a social worker in Cape Cod and a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag people, had a series of dreams about people she did not recognize, but who looked like people she knew. I'm just going to play a short clip.
They were talking to me, and I didn't understand what they were saying. I'd never heard the language before, but it sounded familiar, but I just thought maybe I was getting a little nutty. Sometime after that, I was traveling down this road, and I saw that sign for Sipawisset, and the light just went on, and I thought, oh, you know, I wonder if that's Wampanoag language I'm hearing.
So, Anne, how did you hear of this?
Well, I was actually working on another project when I met Jesse Little Doe Baird and other members of the Wampanoag community. And, of course, when I heard the story of what was going on in the community in terms of bringing back the language, and this is the first time a language has been brought back in a Native American community with no speakers for many generations, more than a century. It's just such an amazing story. Mm. And when I discovered that Jesse's daughter, who was then three, was the first native speaker of Wampanoag in a century, just clearly it was such an amazing, beautiful, ongoing story.
Mr. Currents, is it true that the language had not been spoken at all in like 100 years?
Fluently, yes, that's correct.
Were there elements of the language in your daily life in some way? For example, in the way that there are certain expressions in English that we know about, like rule of thumb, right, that have, you know, historical antecedents but survive even though we don't necessarily know where they came from. Was it something like that?
The term moose is a Wampanoag word, quahog. So those are words that were adopted into the English culture.
Hmm. I'm fast-forwarding a bit here. Jesse Little Doe eventually earned a master's at MIT. The Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project was born. The film highlights the fact, though, that one of the key findings is that a number of contracts and documents from the early colonial era were written in the language, and that the Bible was a key resource. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the great irony of this whole story is that the very first Bible published in the Western Hemisphere was published in Wampanoag at Harvard in 1663. And, of course, it was commissioned by a Harvard teacher minister named John Eliot, who was a missionary to the Wampanoags. And Eliot's purpose, of course, was to transform the Wampanoags into Puritans, basically. I mean, there was to get rid of Wampanoag traditions, Wampanoag religion, Wampanoag cultural life. So this document created to obliterate the culture, very ironically, has become the Rosetta Stone for bringing back the language and with it a lot of understanding of the culture.
Mr. Currents, can I ask you, though, I don't know about you, but I've undertaken to learn languages as an adult. I don't find it as easy as I wish I did. And when you thought about trying to reclaim this language, did you think it would be easy? I know that's it's a relative term, but is it hard?
It is a hard language. It's totally different. I mean, I've had 5 years of Spanish in college, but this was closer to my heart because it's something I could connect to from my past and connect the dots back to my mother, to my grandfather, and my people who came before me. Our ancestors are very important to us. And so that kind of inspires you to pay attention and learn this language in order to bring it back to your people and your community.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm joined by Troy Currents, Vice Chairman of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project, and Anne Makepeace, the producer and director of the PBS film We Still Live Here. It documents the revival of the Wampanoag language. By the way, there is a title. I gave you the English title. Can someone tell me what the title is in Wampanoag?
Well, I'm not going to pronounce it perfectly, but it's something like Asnutayunyun. Troy, do you know how to pronounce it better than that?
That was close. Asnutayunyun. You did pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's hard. It's a hard language. So.
Okay. Well, like he said, the people might be wondering, you know, why does this matter? And I think that it's important sometimes to point out that language is a window into culture and the philosophy of a culture and the values of a culture. And I just want to play a short clip from the film where Nicole Latch is talking about what they learned by studying the language.
One of the first language classes we did, we were asking, what would washkitom, our word for man, what would it mean, really?
and our language teacher said, surface walker, you know. And all the guys were like, yeah, that's so cool, you know, we're surface walkers. And so us women were like, wait, well, what would matamwasas mean, our word for woman? And it was interesting to find that it meant the one who has complete say or judgment. And so all us women were like, yeah, you know.
How about that? So Troy Currents, is there something that the language has unlocked for you in your understanding of your community, your neighbors, yourself?
Yeah, actually it's helped because when we do ceremony, we're able to use some of our own words in ceremonies and prayers and songs. And those are important. So those are like keys that we're missing out of our culture that we're actually retaining and coming back.
But, you know, it's also true that somebody makes the point that this has unlocked aspects of the story of the United States that were previously only told from one point of view. For example, there's a well-known African proverb that says, until the lion has its own voice, the hunter will always tell its story.
Yes.
And I was reminded of this when watching this point where Jesse Littledoe says this, and I'll just play that clip. Here it is.
One of the reasons it's important for me, I think, is because we get to hear what our folks had to say, regardless of what white people wrote in history books. And the only way we can hear our families, I think, is by knowing the language.
And what about that?
Well, I mean, the amazing discovery that Jesse and other Wampanoags made was this treasure trove of documents, not just the Bible. The Bible has been a key in creating the dictionary of Wampanoag words, but there's a whole treasure trove of documents. There are wills, deeds, petitions, marriage bans, letters written phonetically in Wampanoag in the 17th and 18th centuries that are the voices of their ancestors.
But, you know, isn't this part of everyone's history now, though? This is part of the foundational story of this country. I guess what I'm really curious about is, Troy Currents, I read that the Wampanoag classes are only open to Wampanoag. Is that still true? And why is that? I mean, one does not have to be Jewish to study Hebrew.
Right now it is. It's based on household. So you could be Wampanoag and you could have someone who's not Wampanoag living in your household, and it is open to the household. The idea behind that is we're trying to get as many native speakers who are Wampanoag or a Wampanoag household speaking their language because some people don't want to feel embarrassed like, well, hey, this person knows my language and I don't. So I think once we get a better grasp of that as Wampanoag people, then who knows what the future holds.
But I'm pressing the question because now, couldn't one argue that that's kind of racist?
Well, there were a lot of things that were done here on this continent unfairly. We're just trying to reclaim a little piece of the puzzle that is ours.
Yeah, I think that what's been explained to me is that language is considered sacred to the Wampanoag, and they want to guard and protect it and nurture it and bring it to life while it's theirs and not share it.
So, Troy Currents, I have a final question for you, which is the film shows Jesse Littledoe Baird's daughter, May, shown to be the first native speaker in seven generations. Do you think that the next generation of Wampanoag will be fully bilingual? And what do you think that will mean?
I would hope so. What that would mean is that we have more of a voice than we do now in our communities. Right now, there's maybe, I don't even know how many fluent speakers we have. We got a lot. I mean, there's Jesse Littledoe, there's Melanie Rodericks, there's Natana Hicks. There are a few others who fall after them who are very good speakers. So the more speakers we can have, the better the language will be, the more it will evolve. And it's tough to lock language, and that's the key of unlocking it. And as you said, then eventually the language will be free, and it might even be open for other people.
The film in English is called We Still Live Here. And Mr. Currents, if I could impose upon you to tell me the title again in Wampanoag.
Asnatayanan.
The film, which is produced and directed by Anne Makepeace, is about the cultural and linguistic revival of the Wampanoag people. It airs tomorrow night on PBS. You'll want to check your local listings for the exact times. Troy Currents is the vice chairman of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. He joined us from WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. That's NPR's member station on Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket. And Anne Makepeace joins us from her home office in Lakeville, Connecticut. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.